This episode of BoagWorld.com is sponsored by Rightcart, Podvine, and some web design company called Headscape.
Welcome to
BoagWorld.com. The podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites.
This is what everybody waits for.
We're back and better than ever before. Well, we're back anyway. You're listening to the 46th episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing, and running websites on a daily basis. My name is Paul Boag, and joining me once again is Marcus Lazygit Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Marcus, I'm really tanned and brown.
Yes.
That's what it is.
I hate you. Have you any idea how bad my last week has been not having you around?
Oh, that's really quite sweet, actually. So did you miss me?
No. I had to do all of your work. That's why. Disgraceful. 2 weeks in the sun. So is it nice?
It was really nice, but I'm really struggling to get back into work mode.
Yes.
I feel like I'm needing 10 hours sleep a night, and normally I'm a sort of 6 or 7 person.
Relaxed.
I'll nod off at 2 o'clock, probably.
Oh, well. As long as you don't nod off in the middle of the podcast, then that's okay. We sound like old men, don't we?
Yeah. Or I need my sleep.
I need my afternoon nap.
Yeah.
There you go. So anyway, on this week's show, we have what format should you do email newsletters in? We're going to do an introduction or a little bit about accessibility and how to introduce both website owners and developers to the subject of accessibility.
Cool.
We're going to look at selling your web design services and hopefully give a few tips to buyers, in other words, website owners, as to what to look out for when they're being sold to.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to look at the ultimate web design magazine. So there we go. That's today's show. Is that acceptable to you, Marcus?
That sounds like an excellent list.
Now, do you promise to stay awake through it?
Well, I guess I have to do one of those parts, mostly myself.
So yes, being our salesperson, you have to talk about selling. So there you go.
But the other bits I might nod off on.
Okay. Well, just kind of, you know, let me know if you do. I suppose I'll know by the snoring, so that's
exactly
fine. Okay. Normally, at this point, we would do our news section in the podcast, and we'd have a nice little ching-ching-ching introduction bit of music, but I really don't think it's worth it, as this time of year kind of sucks for news. There's, like, nothing going on.
Everyone's on holiday.
Yes. What do they call it? The silly season in the media, don't they? Because nobody can think of decent stories. So it's like, a cat's found up a tree. Wasn't he cute? And that kind of thing. So, no, I haven't got a lot of mention. And those few news stories that I did have, I seem to have already mentioned on the Practical Web Design podcast that I do. So I don't feel like I can talk again about Opera's new mini browser for the Nintendo, or a new browser called Swift that kind of tries to be Safari for Windows. So I guess I have just talked about them a lot, really.
So you did quite a good job there, actually, there, Paul.
But I talk about them more in Practical Web Design podcast. So listen to that if you haven't listened to it before. This is a really commercial episode. We've got sponsors on the beginning. I'm promoting my other podcasts. Oh, well, never mind. One other thing that I wanted to mention. The one news story I have managed to drag from the depths of the web design news bin, if there is such a thing, is the fact that the RNIB, which is, what is that, the Royal
National Institute for the Blind.
Okay, yeah. Who are the big kind of charitable organisation within the UK for promoting the rights of blind people, are running two accessibility courses that I thought might be of interest to you if you're based in the UK. One of them is like an introduction to web accessibility, and they call it demystifying web accessibility. And that's really for kind of website owners that want an overview of why they should care about this kind of stuff. And there's another one that kind of goes a bit more in-depth and gets a bit more technical for web developers. So if you're kind of struggling with the realm of web accessibility and you're interested in knowing more, then it's definitely worth checking those out. As normal, I will put reference to that in our show notes. Now, several people have written in saying, what are these show notes and where are they? Well, I explain at the end of every show, but for some people, they just don't get that far. in the show. Do you know how many people, while you've been away, Marcus, have written to me and gone, where's the podcast? Why isn't it? And I said, well, I announced at the end of the last show that, you know, that we weren't going to be doing one while Marcus was away. And they write back and say, well, I don't listen to the whole thing. I mean, where's their commitment?
Well, yeah, we do tend to do sort of hour and a half long shows, so it's not surprising.
We've never done an hour and a half.
No, I think probably an hour and 10 is the longest.
Although I've got a feeling for the amount of notes you've written for today's show, I think it could be an hour and a half today.
But we'll just talk quickly.
Well, I'm just really insulted that people don't listen to the whole show in rapt attention. Apparently they work while listening to our show.
Blimey, and drive their cars.
And things like that. It's just disgraceful. Anyway, so yes, the show notes, basically, if you go to bowagworld.com/podcast, you'll get a list of all of the shows. If you click on, what are we today, episode 46, you'll find the show notes for today, and that will include a link to this RNIB accessibility course. So there you go. That is as much as news as I could pull out. So let's move on. Okay, so the next segment of our show is our questions and comments. We ask you to send in any questions you have or any comments you've had on previous shows. And today we have two for you. I know you're overexcited, but calm down, we have two. Okay, the first one is from Ryan. Ryan, yes. Here we go. Paul, I love the podcast. Good start. I like that start. You seem like a great guy, and you've helped me out no end with my own digital life. Not quite sure what that means, but thank you very much, Ryan. I'm sure that's good. Now, and then he kind of goes downhill quite dramatically. But for the love of all that is good in the world, there is no such thing as a beta piece of software. It's beta. Do Brits really say the Greek alphabet that way? If so, stop it. Some of our listeners are so confrontational, especially the Americans. I don't know why. Is it something that I've said?
It's probably lots of things you've said, Paul.
Yes, quite possibly. Next week, I've got a really good one to really annoy all the Mac users as well, but I'll save that till next week. Well, Ryan, I mean, call me kind of naive, call me simplistic, but when I read a word, I pronounce it the way that it's written. So if it's written with an E, I say beta. It's not spelled B-A-Y-T-A, like you seem to imply that it is.
Hang on. This argument doesn't stand up. Because
why?
if it was an E, it makes an E sound. So that means you should pronounce it better. Okay. Sorry, I'm siding with Ryan here.
This is not good. But then beta, pronounce it E sound. Some words are pronounced with an E sound. That's okay. But where do you get beta from?
That's Greek, isn't it? I'm looking up on dictionary.com.
Well, all I can say is this seems to be a general trend of Americans. Okay? Take herb. Right?
Oh, yes.
They just randomly remove the H. Herb. What's an herb? Anyway. So I don't want you to look it up on dictionary because you'll only prove me wrong. I prefer to live in my own little blissful world.
I'm afraid it's pronounced beta, but
there you go. Oh, no, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Beta. But, do I really have to start saying beta?
No, you don't. No, continue. Well, I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say beta, but there you go.
I'm sure everybody that's anybody says beta.
Of course they do.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to a proper question. This one is from Aaron, who's writing in from Boston. Actually, he's not writing in. He sent an MP3 file, which is very nice of him. So you can listen to for yourself as to what Aaron has to say.
Hi, Paul. This is Aaron from Boston. My organization is looking to produce an HTML newsletter to be delivered via email. We're being advised to forgo web standards on this project in favor of a table-based layout. The argument being that the realm of mail clients is too diverse to predict, and the most popular one, Microsoft Outlook, has mostly poor support for web standards for all of its versions. So aside from the ease of redesign and accessibility concerns, is forgoing web standards on an HTML newsletter a good idea?
Now that's what I call proper feedback. Proper questions. None of this beta malarkey. Thank you, Aaron, for raising the tone of the show.
It's not hard, is it?
No, it isn't. It's a brilliant point. Very good question, and one that I feel that is definitely worth talking about. Is it possible to build emails with web standards? Yes, it is. You can actually do it. There was a thing, I think, on the Alista Park website a little while back when they did a whole series of tests on different email clients and that kind of stuff, and they did actually succeed in building something using web standards. Was it easy? Hell no. It turned into a bit of a major nightmare, and I have to say, I don't know whether it's worth the hassle. If you are going to go with an HTML newsletter, and I want to kind of debate that in a minute, but if you are, then I think a lot of the benefits of using web standards that you get from using it on a website don't necessarily apply to email. So in some ways, it's probably not as worthwhile. And also, the problem that the guy, whichever article it was that I was reading that tested all of this, is that especially with the web-based email clients, a lot of them overrode any style sheet that you apply to them anyway and kind of forced their own style sheet on top of it. So you could end up with a real kind of gooey mess of styles all conflicting with one another if you're not careful. So it's a pretty tough one. But I have to say that I think my advice on it is actually just use plain text. HTML, and this is probably where you're going to disagree with me, Marcus, because I don't know whether what you feel about this, but in my experience, HTML newsletters, they just cause a lot of problems. I think I'd prefer to send a plain text email that points somebody at an online version of a newsletter. So, you know, basically you have a cut down version that's sent as an email, and that then points to a web page that has kind of more details, you know, and a kind of fleshed out HTML version of the newsletter, in which case you can use web standards. And kind of my problem with HTML emails are kind of multifold. Is that even a word? Multifold. Yes.
I quite like it.
It's a good word.
You've just invented a new word.
I know, that's good.
Along with beta.
Yes, exactly. the first thing to say is that obviously HTML newsletters often kind of find themselves conflicting with spam filters. So, you know, with so much of the traffic flying around the web being spam, especially larger organizations are kind of putting more and more stringent kind of filters in place in order to kind of prevent spam getting through. And one of them is just to kind of ban all HTML email, which is very extreme, but a lot of organizations do it. So you avoid spam filters by going for plain text. Also, see, another reason why the network Nazis that you get in large organizations that are kind of in control of this type of thing, another reason they don't like HTML newsletters is because they're more likely to carry a virus with them than plain text. Also, there's all the reformatting issues. Even if you go with normal HTML, you can never quite guarantee what an email client is going to do with your email newsletter. So, again, there's reformatting issues. Mm. Outlook, in particular, is really bad for this. I don't know, especially with the newer versions. If you load a HTML newsletter into Outlook, you get a load of blank boxes, basically. Wherever there's an image, it won't download the image until you specifically ask it. So all the kind of visual impact, which is the big selling point for HTML newsletters, are lost because your email client kind of overrides that and just kind of, you know, won't download any of the images that make it attractive. So the big argument for marketing people is, oh, well, HTML newsletters are more visually engaging and grab people's attention. Well, they don't in Outlook. Also, if your email client can't support HTML, you just get a load of garbage code, which is, you know, really bad. And okay, there are ways around that these days, but it's still complicating things unnecessarily. And also, obviously, a lot of people are hesitant about email HTML newsletters because they will download, you know, they can potentially connect back to the server and say, yes, this person has opened or viewed your email, which is not always a good thing. Hmm. So, all in all, I think HTML newsletters suck. So, there you go.
Well, I don't think they suck.
Oh, right. Okay, go on then.
Well, I agree with you, generally speaking, that the kind of standard HTML newsletter doesn't work, and the best way of doing it is providing an email that you know, gives a link back to a web page where you can basically create your newsletter using, you know, content management system or whatever.
Yeah.
But plain text, you know, standard plain text emails in Korea New Text or whatever they are kind of so...
In what? Korean New Text?
Korea New.
Oh, Korea.
Korea? Korea?
I say Korea. We can't even pronounce beta, this beta. Properly. Beta beta. We're back to it again. All right, yes, carry on.
They're kind of like, they're almost like spam or trash in themselves. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, the ideal, and this is what I'm probably showing my ignorance about how you can format newsletters, I think, or emails, is to have some form of branding, even if it's just a logo. If you can just have a logo, your message and the link back to the web page, that's the ideal. But I'm not sure how possible that is. But I do receive quite a lot of emails that just include a logo, and I use Outlook, and it doesn't block that image. So there must be a way of doing it.
It doesn't block that image?
No.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, I guess you can do that kind of stuff. And just to keep it very simple, if you are going to have formatting, because there's also something called rich text format, which a lot of clients support as well.
Yeah.
So that might be the way to go. I mean,
maybe that's what that you know, they're including a logo, including an image.
Yeah.
Because they're usually an attachment.
I know what you mean. Yes, I know what you mean. Yes, they're almost certainly rich text.
Okay.
But yeah, either way, I don't think web standards is the way to go with email. It's far too complicated. Isn't it funny how we can take a simple question and ramble on about it and go off onto complete tangents? But there you go.
So yes, that's what we're really good at, Paul.
Question and comments for today. Let's move on to the main feature before this podcast gets any longer. Bugbear.com. Okay, so for a while now, we've had people screaming at us, asking us to talk about selling your services online. Selling your web design services. But we've kind of always been a bit hesitant doing it because we didn't want to focus too much on web designers and developers and kind of shut out our website owners audience and that this was a bit specific to kind of the kind of development community and people running agencies, etc. But we've had so many people write to us asking us about it, we finally cracked and decided just to chat a little bit about how we, as in Headscape, sell our web design services and how we go about doing things. And hopefully we can pull out a few tidbits along the way for website owners to help them kind of assess web design agencies as they're talking to them and perhaps pick up on some things to help you choose an agency. Now, I know we've talked about this in more depth before about how to pick a web design agency, but hopefully there's a few things in here for you guys as well. And of course, as Marcus is the salesperson in Headscape, it's primarily down to you to put forward a convincing argument for our wonderful sales process.
Ah, oh dear, but it's certainly not written in stone. But I kind of, Paul said to me this morning, you do remember that you're doing this you know, selling your services thing. It's like, okay, so I've written down a whole bunch of bits,
whole load of random points in no particular order.
In no particular order, and I've probably missed out some hugely important items as ever. But anyway, that's the caveat over.
I wouldn't worry about it, Marcus. I forget things every week.
And you're consistently reminded by
Or I just make things
thousands
up.
Of listeners.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. Anyway, I've kind of split it into three areas. One is just general stuff about selling yourself. The other one's marketing, and the other one is pitching for work, which is kind of like when you've actually got a real client to talk to and they're asking you questions. But to start off with the general stuff, fairly importantly, play to your strengths. I've always wanted to do band websites. The example I've written down here is if you want to work with rock bands, but if your experience centres on software companies, or in our case on websites for the over 50s, don't waste time on chasing rock bands, because you know, basically what it comes down to is you need to focus on your strengths and obviously show people that you've done work in a particular area. And if you can't show the rock band another rock band's website, chances are they won't be interested in you.
You've just blown any chance we're ever going to have of doing a rock band. Now you say you made it sound like we only ever work on websites for the over 50s.
Well, we do, don't we?
Well, we do all these higher education sites. They're all like 16-year-olds.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. So we should be doing lots of rock band websites.
Exactly. There you go. Carry on.
Next point is don't overstretch yourself. Don't go chasing 100k contracts if it's just you or you and your mate kind of thing.
Duh.
Well, you know, it's, you might think, well, we can do this, you know, but chances are, even if you could do it, they won't pick you because there's only two of you.
Yeah.
We've been, you know, we've had that. There's 10 of us, and we've lost out because purely because of our size to the other company that's got 30 people in it.
Yeah, we have.
It just, clients will feel more comfortable with a bigger organisation. That's just natural. That's the way it goes. And sometimes you'll lose because of that, and nothing you can do about it. But I guess, you know, don't take anything on early on if you think, well, there's no hope of us winning this particular one.
Mm.
Allied to that particular point, clients tend, you know, if they're putting out a brief or, you know, a tender for a piece of work, they'll tend to want to work with one supplier for the entire project. They, you know, they'll accept multiple bids or bids from multiple companies, but they tend to prefer working with one supplier. So try and avoid going for projects, I guess, where you can't deliver one major part of it, unless it's specifically, you know, that there, it's something that the client in question is saying, we're expecting to get a particular supplier for this bit and a different one for this bit. But, you know, be wary of that.
So are you talking about outsourcing there? About,
yeah.
Yeah, so in Headscape's case, you know, if there was a particular skill set that we lacked, you're saying that clients like to know that all of it is going to be done by your in-house team rather than outsourced.
they prefer it. I guess I'm just it's something to be wary of. I mean, you may have a really good relationship with, say, a particular technical supplier, and if that relationship is excellent, then there's no reason at all why you can't sort of, you know, bid together for a particular project. But obviously, be upfront about it. Don't make out that you're not doing that, because I'm particularly public sector insist that they have the details of, you know, your granny and whoever's working for you's granny. But
those grannies are a real liability in projects.
They are, absolutely. But it's, if you, if there's only one tiny bit of a project that you think you can bid for, chances are you're not going to win it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, just be wary of that kind of thing. This is just, it's just relating to playing to your strengths. Go for something where you can deliver all of it or nearly all of it. Chances are you'll stand a much better chance of winning it than one where it's just a small bit.
Mm.
That's all I'm saying, really.
Mm.
And but also, don't promise something you can't deliver, because you'll be well, you'll regret it, basically. And that includes things like timescales. It's very easy to say, oh, yes, no problem, we can deliver this in, you know, 5 days. But it's pretty rare that you'll be able to do that kind of thing. So realistic.
I mean, that is something, if you're somebody that's commissioning a web design company, you need to be so careful over that, because web design companies do promise that they can deliver before they really can. I mean, we've come across that with projects before, where we know it doesn't matter how big that organisation is, there is no way they can physically complete the work within the timescales the client's laid out. And they take it on knowing that the project, you know, project's going to slip, and they're not up front, and they don't discuss that with the client up front. So it's something you do need to kind of be wary of. But I think that's such a false economy, because, I mean, I'm sure you're going to come on to referrals later, but you really don't get, you know, if you're letting clients down and if you're deceiving them, they're not going to recommend you to other people.
Of course they're not.
Anyway, carry on.
Next point, you know, next random point that entered my brain was about vertical sales.
God, these really are random, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, no, not really, but that's a kind of real salesy term, isn't it? What I mean is going after business in similar sectors. That's vertical sales. It's a real kind of marketing sales term, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Have a look, research, you know, the clients that you have worked with and are working with, and look at the sectors that they're in. And then if you're going to try and chase after particular tenders or cold call anybody, go after those sectors, because you've got a story, and that's and you've also got references, hopefully, you know, as long as you haven't pissed your clients off. You're in so much a stronger position than if you're going for some you know, random sector that you've never worked in before. Mm. This is all fairly obvious stuff, but concentrate on those sectors, because sales is hard work, especially if you're, you know, if you're looking for new business. Go look at where your strengths. This is still relating to playing to your strengths. That's why it is a relevant point.
Cunning.
Yeah, Yeah, as I say, just note what your sectors are, and if you win work in a new sector, which does come up, then you know, make sure that you chase after work in that sector again. You've opened up a new whole new area.
Yeah, I mean, a good example for us was that when we originally set up, we won the National Trust website,
absolutely,
which was a big piece of work for us, and that enabled us to attract clients within the kind of heritagey countryside type sector. So we went through a whole load of them for a long time, and we really kind of became the dominant player within that sector. And then after that, we won just out of the blue, didn't we? University of Portsmouth, I think it was. And they liked us on the basis of the National Trust work, but obviously they were a different sector. And so once we'd finished that work for them, we said, right, okay, we're going to specifically target the higher education sector. And so didn't we do a load of letters and actually, you know, wrote to them all? I can't remember.
I did with the within the heritage sector.
Oh, no, that was the heritage sector.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was such an obvious group, it was in, you know, particular areas of outstanding natural beauty in the UK. We had this great story, and I think we'd worked with one or two AONBs, and it just sort of made sense to kind of say, you know, just flag up, say, look, this is who we are. Please talk to us. Mm. It wasn't a hard sell. It was just sort of, this is the work we've done. Isn't it good, kind of thing, and you know, talk to the other people that you probably know, and give us a call when you're ready to do, you know, to have a look at your website.
I remember the approach you used with higher education. We built such a good relationship with the client at Portsmouth that I was able to actually go to him and say, well, you know, what publications, what organisations, what mailing lists are you on? And from the kind of responses that he gave us from that, I started writing articles for an organisation called Herder, which are big within the higher education sector and everybody pays attention to. He invited...
Hero, wasn't it?
Was it?
Hero.
Hero, not Herder. No, of course, Hero, sorry. And then also I joined... he invited me to a mailing list of a load of institutional kind of higher education website manager people, and I just contributed to that mailing list. I didn't spam it, I didn't advertise in it, but I just kind of contributed to it and joined in the conversations and that kind of stuff, and slowly word of mouth crept round, and we did one or two other projects and they recommended us to others. The good thing is when you can find a vertical sector that is very incestuous, I think is probably the word. Yeah. The great thing about both heritage and higher education is that even though they're in competition with one another, they don't really view it like that. And they talk with one another quite a lot, and they share ideas, and they recommend people to one another. But if you're going for a very, very competitive sector, then that's harder to do. Like, for example, some of our e-commerce sites, clients have actually asked us to write into the contract that we will not work for their competition.
Yeah, I mean, I was just about to say that. You've got to be pretty wary of your existing clients in a particular sector. You've got to ask yourself, well, if I go and work for this other organisation within this sector, is that going to piss them off badly? Chances are it won't, but yeah, you've got to ask yourself that question, certainly.
But there is a kind of another approach you can take if you get into that kind of situation. So a kind of another type of vertical selling, really, which is that instead of kind of looking for comparative clients within that same sector, what you do is you look up and down the supply chain. So, you know, if you're working with somebody that is a reseller of a product, you go back to the provider, the manufacturer of the product, or, you know, with the recommendation from that reseller that we're a good client, and so on and so on. You can kind of work that way as well, which works quite well. Anyway, I'm making this even longer than it would have been.
That's all right. No, this is the most important part, definitely, because this is all talking about... I mean, I've already said it, but I think the most important thing is that to be able to impress someone, obviously, if you can go in and say, I can save you money, then that's going to be, you know, you're in a hugely strong position, but we're really ignoring that, because most of the time with web design work, you can't say that. We're looking at changing and improving your brand online. You may be able to say that you can, you know, by doing building a particular site, you can get more sales leads in, but again, very difficult to kind of nail down up front how that's going to save a particular client some money. So what we're looking at here is how to impress that potential client is based on existing work.
So, and to be honest, even if you can save money, like, you know, if you have this website, it will reduce the number of calls you get or whatever. Mm. Even when you can do that, any of the other web design companies can say similar things. So it doesn't really differentiate you in the sales process.
Exactly. Which brings me nicely along to existing clients.
The best of all types.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing I've written down here is that existing clients should make up a large percentage of your turnover. Mm. If they don't, you're doing something wrong. Because, as Paul said many a time, web design work is not sort of, or it shouldn't be, one piece of work here and then 5 years later another piece of work. It's to do it properly and to have the most effective website, it's a continual process. So, yeah, your existing clients should... they certainly should make up a large amount of the work that you do over any year. So keep in touch with those clients. Hold annual or biannual meetings that are effectively sales meetings for you, although probably from the client's point of view, they're review meetings of how the site's working. But you need to go along with a whole bunch of new ideas that, you know, we could do this, a long list of improvements or additions to the site that will probably nearly always manage to excite that client and say, yeah, that'd be great, we could add this on. And they're already hopefully happy with you and happy with the work you've done. So it's a very, very easy sell. And we're talking about selling here. You know, I can't remember, it's something like it's 10 times harder to win a new client than it is to win work with an existing client. So, you know, concentrate on this and make sure that, this is a large part of what you do.
I was going to say that the underlying thing with that is you have to do a good job for your clients.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And really, if I could only share one thing about sales, it would be that. Do a good job. Because if you do a good job, they recommend you to other people. They're likely to come back to you again. You know, I know it sounds trite, but that is by far the most effective sales technique there is, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, there's two, I suppose. There's do it like that, or there's cut and run, and never keep a client. But that takes a kind of crook's mentality to be able to work like that. So
sounds like a lot of hard work as well. Bearing in mind what you just said, is it's 10 times harder to win a new client than an existing one. I go for the route of least resistance personally.
Dead right. Also on existing clients, ask them to be, you know, to provide references for you. Not only does this give you a reason to talk to your existing clients out of the blue, and hopefully they'll be pleased to hear from you, it's a kind of way of impressing them, if you like. It's you're going for that big job or whatever, whether you win it or not, or if you do win it on, you can obviously let them know and thank them for the references, etc. It's a really good way of A, keeping your profile up with that company and just generally keeping in touch.
Mm.
All of that said, beware of going for too much, going for the wrong projects. I kind of already covered that a little bit in the first part of this, but be prepared to walk away, is what I'm saying.
That's hard to do, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. But often, when you particularly time scales, but often with budget as well, it isn't a viable thing to go for a particular piece of work. And you have to say to yourself, you know, we're in a position where we may actually hack off our existing clients if we take this piece of work on, especially if we win it. Mm. Going through the process of, you know, maybe having to do mock-up work as part of a proposal, which would affect the existing projects. So you've got to be very aware of what you're working on, what's likely to come in, and just, you know, don't overdo it, because you could end up just messing everything up. I guess what I'm just trying to say is think about the sales process as much as you would your project management.
Mm. Two need to be integrated in some way, that, you know, that you can kind of, the project managers know how much sales work is about to come through the door, and the salesperson knows what our current workload is.
Mm. Yeah, two need to talk to each other regularly.
Yes. Which I've got to admit, only relatively recently have we got right.
Well, we've put ourselves in a position too many times when we have gone for work and we've won it and it's just been hair
tearing. And then it's like,
Because what happens is you win that piece of work and everyone's great, but then a week later you win another, say, a project with an existing client that you were almost dead certain that you were going to win. You knew it was coming, and then it just totally throws everything. Now, if you'd thought about it, you knew that particular piece of work was coming in, so you shouldn't have gone for the other one in the first place.
I know, but that's so, it's so difficult to do. It really is difficult to do.
There's nothing black and white in that, but just, yeah, as I've said, think about it. Think about the whole process. If you're suddenly going to win 10 projects and you're fairly sure you're going to win them all, can you do 10 projects? Probably not. So, and then everyone ends up getting upset with you. And you don't do a good job, and then you don't get referrals, blah, blah, blah. It all sort of goes on. So it's, even though it's probably against kind of, you know, the sales ethos that you want to win everything, it's actually could damage you. So be aware of that.
I think we ought to skip marketing.
Yeah, because it's boring.
No, it's not boring. It's the bit that I like and I'm passionate about. I think we ought to do a separate podcast on that one day because that's a really good area. So let's skip over marketing for now and move on to actually doing the pitch because it's always a difficult bit for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, marketing was just talking about, you know, how to promote your business.
It's not just.
But it's not specifics, is it?
Can you tell that bit Marcus doesn't do and I deal with? So he considers it less worthy. Things I put up with.
I'm just going to spend 1 minute on marketing. You need to look at the marketing is very relevant to the kind of business you're after. If you are a one-man band and you're after fairly small projects, then how you market is very different to how you market if you're after very big projects. But we'll go into the details of that because there is a lot of different avenues you can go down there.
Yeah.
But yes, okay, pitching for work.
Yeah, so you've got through the door and the prospect is just hanging there waiting for you to convince them. Because it normally works for us that they issue an invitation to tender. You respond to that with some kind of written document or whatever.
Yep.
Then they shortlist to what, three normally, although it does vary a bit. And then you go in and you present to them. And that's basically what decides who wins and who doesn't. And so that ability to present and be convincing and to be good in that situation is kind of key to your success. And I think there are a lot of web design companies out there that may be very competent but just aren't very convincing in this kind of environment. And that really sucks because equally there are a lot of web design companies out there that are incompetent when it comes to actually building things but are just very convincing in a sales situation. So I think it's really important to know how to do a good pitch and also how to interpret a pitch and to judge whether the company's any good or not. So go on then. How do you do it?
So pitching is... If we're talking about the sort of like a formal response to a tender is made up of two things, which is your proposal and your presentation.
Okay.
Quite often, you know, pitching for work can be an email quote, but that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is that you've received a brief from a client. I mean, commercial clients tend to just send you a document and say, give us a proposal. They'll still want to talk to you. They'll still want you to go in and present. So the same process you have to go through, whether it's public sector or private, but we're talking about sort of fairly large chunky piece of work here. We want a new website, effectively, is what we normally respond to. First question, the first thing you've got to ask yourself, is it for you? I mean, we've already covered this is the walking away bit. Can you deliver what they're asking for within their budget and with their timescales, and have you got the skills to do it? If the answer to all that is yes, then great, move on to the next point. If it isn't, then you kind of maybe seriously think about whether you want to respond, because there's a lot of effort goes into these things. But the next point is obviously read through the brief and ask questions. Ask as many questions as you want. They'll be expecting you to get back to them. And also remember that the person writing the brief is almost certainly not as au fait with web design, you know, building as you are. They'll be woolly about what they want. So you need to nail down early on what their requirements really are. Because often what I find in tenders is an awful lot of emphasis will be put on a particular area, and there'll be one little sentence down the bottom about another area, and actually they're equal. You know, the emphasis is equal on both of them, and you might even miss one point, which is actually really important. So talk to them, about every single aspect of the brief that they've sent through. And this also may mean making suggestions to them. They will expect that. Be creative in your response. It's obviously you've got to respond to their brief and provide actual responses to the things they're asking and how you would do it, but also suggest, well, we could do this, or we might be able to go along this particular route. And if you do that, then obviously you've got to explain that this is a new idea, and also provide prices and separate out those prices for those new ideas.
I think actually there's a tip in that for website owners, people that are actually commissioning web design companies, that it would be easy to kind of go, oh, this company has obviously grasped our brief much better because they haven't hassled us endlessly with loads of questions. While this company seems to be questioning everything, and why are they asking all of these questions? Don't go down that route. People that ask questions are being more proactive on a project. They're trying to engage with the project more, understand it more. Absolutely. So probably their proposal will be more in depth as a result.
Exactly. And basically, with the questions, if they're not thousands of miles away from you, and we're talking about a reasonably sized project, go in and sit around a table, have a pre-presentation or pre-proposal meeting with them. Most clients will be impressed by that, so do it. Okay, so now you've got all your answers and you've got to put your proposal together. If it's a formal tender, i.e. public sector type thing, make sure you include all the formal bits, the name of the tender, the reference. Quite often you'll have to send back signed bits of paper, with stating your company number and all this kind of stuff. Make sure you do all of that, because otherwise they'll just bin your proposal if it's not done properly. If they ask for 28 printed copies, give them 28 printed copies. So you'd be amazed. All right, 28 is a huge exaggeration, but I have had to provide 10 before.
Cool, blimmin' it.
Well, it's basically everyone on the panel that's going to select you has to have their own printed copy.
Yeah, I guess so.
But that is rare.
I think there's a point there to raise as well. Sorry, I keep coming in on the side of the website owners.
That's good.
Don't be unrealistic in your expectations of the web design companies that you're asking to tender. This is an expensive process for them. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And just don't be greedy by asking them for too much. And the reason that I'm saying that is not just because I'm a web designer that works for a web agency, but we have turned down projects before on the basis of the fact that there has been too much. In fact, we did it very recently. We turned down a project because there was too much work involved. We know we would have been ideally suited for that project, and we're in actually a very good position to win it. But we turned it down because the amount of work in the tendering process was so large that it actually put us off. We're very busy as an agency. We've got a lot of work on. We're very popular and all the rest of it. And so they drove us out. They basically drove us out of the marketplace. And what they're leaving themselves with is the web design agencies that aren't so busy, are a bit desperate for work, and have got the time to put into these kind of proposals. So you have to walk this very fine line about what you ask for and what you don't.
Yeah, well, I mean, providing initial designs is a very good example of that. Do you really want one of your designers to go off paid work to put together spend a day or two for doing some initial mock-ups?
Asking for a couple of designs for a couple of different pages is one thing, but when a client is asking for six different templates in two different design styles, that's days and days worth of work. Sometimes that is justified depending on the size of the project, but it has to be a fairly big project to justify that amount of work. And just kind of bear in mind that what you're asking for, and don't necessarily respond negatively to a design agency that says, well, actually, we can't provide you with everything you're asking for the tender process, but we suggest that this is a good solution instead. Mm. And, you know, hear out those other solutions. And because, you know, I think that demonstrates something about that web design company. One, that they're busy and they've got lots going on. But secondly, that they're, you know, they're confident enough to kind of make suggestions to you and suggest a different approach and other ways of achieving your goals. And you want that kind of proactive approach in a web design company. Well, at least I think you do.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes back to the point earlier about asking questions and nailing down requirements. This is very much part of it. You know, so if they're asking for 10 different concept designs and you're thinking, well, hang on, we're not going to do that, you've got to say, ask the question up front. We're prepared to do one concept as part of our proposal. If we do that, you know, will it affect our chances of winning the work? And if the answer to that is yes, then chances are you probably should walk away.
Yeah.
But there you go. The next point I've written down, and this is so important,
it's written in caps. It's in four exclamation marks.
Respond to the brief. Don't invent your own. It's so common. It's like, well, this is how we do proposals. So we're going to do it like this, and this is what we're proposing to build for you. And it actually isn't responding to the brief itself. Often, what I'll do in proposals that I send out is you'll often get a list of requirements. Just take each requirement and respond to that with, you know, with a paragraph about that particular requirement, and then, you know, cross reference to another area of the proposal where you go into more detail about what that relates to. You're basically answering their questions, rather than sort of inventing their questions for them. So that's all I'm saying. Really important. Respond to the brief.
And you get a lot of web design companies as well, especially those with their own content management systems that kind of reinterpret the brief in order to crowbar their own technology into it.
Oh,
that always
yeah.
amuses me.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, that's you know, beware of that. Mm. If you're the one delivering the tender. Include relevant information about you and your work. Obviously, everyone's going to do that, but review it, because obviously it's very easy just to go, you know, last proposal we wrote, slap that bit in because it's exactly the same. It isn't, because the important word in that, what I've just said, was relevant. Obviously, if you're responding to a public sector heritage client, their particular brief, it's going to be totally different to an e-commerce site that's selling widgets of some sort, and you need to basically, you know, change the examples you're giving that are relevant to that particular brief. Be detailed. Obviously, people are going to want to. The people that you're sending this proposal to have to decide between you and probably five or six others. So, give them a lot of detail about what you're going to do, but don't overdo it, because no one wants to read a 100-page proposal. And often, we'll often receive tenders where they limit it. You have 10 sides of A4. And then we're down to 6-point Arial and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think you always live by your own advice on this one.
I have to say
some of our proposals get a bit long.
But that's because I like to include a lot of screenshots and a lot of diagrams, because I think people like seeing pictures.
That is true. Yeah.
They don't, you know, reading reams and reams and reams of text can get really, really tedious after a while.
I'll tell you the other thing relating to screenshots is that something that I fell foul of for a long time is I go, well, people can look at our website to see examples of work we do. But you convinced me, and I think rightly so now, that actually a lot of the people that are reviewing the project haven't and will not see the website. You make the presumption that the person that sent out the invitation tender to you is the person making the decision. So therefore, they will have found you via your website and they would have had a good look round. That's a presumption I always made. But actually, oftentimes, your proposal gets handed up the food chain, so to speak, from the marketing person that was, you know, had found your website and looked through it and decided to offer you the chance to tender. And it goes from them up to the MD that is the person that's actually making the final decision. So you can't rely on people seeing your website.
That's why it's good to, you know, put a bit of effort into what your printed proposals actually look like. You know, decent paper with covers, etc. You know, it should... it's worth doing that, because chances are the MD is going to be, you know, he will make a judgment, he, she will make a judgment based on how you present yourself, especially if it's for a design project. So, yeah. You know, just bear that in mind. I'm sure I've already given that as a tip quite recently. But also, if you're going to include loads of screenshots and diagrams, make sure, be wary of the document size, especially if you're emailing it to somebody. Times I've had 20 megabyte proposals.
Yeah.
I thought, right, I need to reduce that slightly. Moving on to pricing, make sure you break your pricing down as much as you possibly can. Obviously, in a proposal, you're in a kind of, we could do this for you, we, you know, it would be great if we could do this, this, and this. But based upon that, you need to split it into as small bits as possible. Because if you're too expensive, if you've given... For example, if you've given you know, a long list of areas, you know, you've broken the pricing down, then it's easy for that client to say, well, we don't really need that bit, and they can cross it out and therefore remove that cost and hopefully therefore make you competitive.
Because briefs can often be wish lists rather than actual requirements.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah.
And also, I mean, really important, include relevant references. Again, relevant references. It's a really important thing. Sometimes I won't include references if they're not asked for, because then I can talk about it more in the presentation stage. You know, it's a very powerful way to finish a presentation if you can say, well, this is all very well. Of course, we're going to say we're the best thing since sliced bread, but talk to any one of our clients and, you know, they'll support that. So you can leave it, I guess, but at some point within the whole pitching process, then certainly make sure that you provide some references to existing clients. I've jumped onto presentations then, haven't
you?
I
have, very seamlessly.
Seamlessly onto presentations. Some really, this again, seems kind of a really small point, but find out how long you've got for your presentation.
Oh, yes.
Times
we're terrible at shooting. Like this podcast, actually.
Well, yeah, you can imagine what we like in a presentation. I think that, generally speaking, for a kind of reasonably sized project, you need an hour and a half, because you need three-quarters of an hour to an hour to do your presentation. And then you need three quarters to half an hour to talk about it afterwards. An hour never seems to be enough. But find out. I mean, ask if it's possible to have an hour and a half. If it's not, then you just need to know what you've got to fit in and obviously adjust your presentation accordingly. It's good to know how many other people are doing a presentation, where you are in the day.
Mm-hmm.
If you're first, you're last, etc. Because if you're last, chances are, you know, they'll be, you know, if you're last of eight people on one day, then they're going to be really sick of it by that point. And, you know, make a joke of it, lighten it up, if you like. It's just, you know, kind of good to know where you are within that particular process. Also, make sure you've got an expert with you. It's all very well three of your best salesmen turning up in their best suits and then sort of bluffing their way around questions. Chances are, you know, me talking about detailed technical stuff is not going to impress anyone. It's not, is it?
No.
Well, I can't talk about detailed technical stuff. That's why it's not going to impress anyone. So obviously, if you've got a very technical-led proposal, make sure you've got somebody there who can, you know, answer the questions that are no doubt going to be thrown at them. Prepare a quality presentation, normally with PowerPoint. People will expect that. Obviously, within the web design world, they're going to expect a PowerPoint presentation over a bunch of, you know, sort of manual boards, if you like. I can't think what they're called.
Yeah, that used by advertising agencies. I can't remember what they're called either. My brain's gone dead.
Those things.
don't worry about it.
But make sure it's, you know, if you're looking for a design job here, that your PowerPoint looks the part. It's a well-designed presentation, because again, it's about impressing people and impressing them with, you know, your skills, if you like. Explain what differentiates you. That's a really important thing. That's how we normally finish off, is go through all the things and why you should choose Headscape. Chances are that will be in tandem with quite a lot of other agencies, but it's a good thing to spell out what you do and what you think makes you different.
Hmm.
Also, and this is can be quite a tricky one, be prepared to discuss prices when you're in that particular meeting, because often people want to, often they won't, but often they will, and you have to sit and talk prices. But and timescales is another one. But obviously you need to be flexible, but don't dig your own grave over it. Don't agree to cutting the price in half and doing it in 2 weeks, because you will regret it once again.
Yeah.
Normally that kind of thing will come after, but be prepared to do it, because particularly commercial clients will want to talk about money there and then. And that's kind of it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing I'd say about presentations is that ultimately the client already knows what you're capable of doing by that stage. They've already seen your proposal. They've obviously shortlisted you already if they're getting as far as interviewing you. So they're fairly positive about you. I think the two things that presentations are about primarily is, one, allowing them to get their questions answered.
Mm-hmm.
So always leave a lot of time for questions. And two, just to be able to judge whether they can work with you or not.
Absolutely.
We've had a lot of clients that basically have decided to go out with us just because they like us, more than anything else.
Strange, isn't it? But yeah.
I know, but, you count odds people, can you, and their taste. So, be engaging, be entertaining, be informative. Be proactive. You need to come across positively in those meetings, but don't be over salesy. I'm not a great fan of having old-fashioned salespeople going along to these meetings. They want to talk with the people that they're going to be working with on the project. They don't want to be just talking to a salesperson. Now, I know, Marcus, you are a salesperson, but normally one of the development team will go along with you, certainly for the final pitch.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think that's really important, because you need to know who you're going to be working with and how the project's going to work. You don't want to just be talking to some slick salesperson. So, yeah, I think that about wraps it up. We have done a massive 40 minutes on that subject. So hopefully now people will not complain anymore that we haven't covered it. So let's move on as quickly as possible. Okay, I know we're running short on time, but I'd like to do a quick review. Each week we try and do a review of a different website or book or whatever. This week we're going to do a magazine. I don't know whether you're aware or not, but for a while now I've been writing a little piece for the .NET magazine, which is a big web design magazine here in the UK. They approached me a while back and asked me if I would be their design guy, so I tend to answer questions that people have got relating to front-end interface design. And I've been doing this for a while, but I haven't seen the magazine for years. Years and years, and to be honest, I never really liked it very much. It was very, very techie, far too techie for my tastes, and it never really caught my interest particularly. But I thought, I'm writing for the magazine, I really ought to subscribe to it to at least see what it's like. Also, I was kind of prompted to do so because Dan Oliver, who used to be the editor-in-chief of the Practical Web Design magazine, whose podcast I do, has moved across now to .NET, and I thought, oh well, let's see what's happening with the magazine, what he's doing with it. And I have to say, it is absolutely superb now. It really has turned into an excellent magazine. They've got themselves an advisory panel, which I think has helped no end, of kind of big names within the world of web design. For example, it's got Molly from Molly.com, it's got Andy Budd on, and Andy Clark on. So it's got some decent names that have obviously kind of pointed them in the right direction and made it a real good magazine for professional web designers. They've redesigned the look and feel of it, certainly from when I saw it, but admittedly that was probably a long time ago. But what I like most of all is that it's not techie anymore. I mean, it's got technical stuff in, sure, but it's a real good balance of articles and news covering all aspects of web design. And so not only can I kind of recommend this to professional web designers, but I think I can also recommend it to website owners. Now, they probably wouldn't buy it every month. I wouldn't necessarily recommend you subscribe to it. But there's certainly stuff in each magazine that is useful to know, even if you're, you're not actually working on websites and building websites, but you're running them. For example, the lead story in the September issue, which is the one I'm looking at now, is how to make your website stand out from the crowd. And it's all kind of marketing information, really, which is useful to know if you're a website owner. So there's definitely stuff in here that would appeal to you as a website owner as well as a web design professional. It's really good. It's not for the amateur market. That's where practical web design comes in. But I would highly recommend you at least get hold of one issue and just check it out. I'm guessing you can subscribe from their website, which is netmag.co.uk. But I'm pretty sure you can pop into a WH Smith if you're in the UK and buy yourself a copy there. Okay, so that wraps up the review.
Birdworld.com.
Well, we warned you it was coming, and finally it is here. We now have some sponsors for the BoagWorld.com podcast. You probably heard them at the beginning of the show. Well, we now have three sponsors at the moment, and no doubt that will change on a regular basis. But I just wanted to tell you a little bit about each of our sponsors and why I think they're worthy of your attention. The first one is Podvine. Now, Podvine is the podcast advertising network that BoagWorld is a part of. So if you're interested in seeing your product or service or website advertised on BoagWorld and a number of other leading web design podcasts, then scoot over to podvine.com. And check out all of the information about us there. Or you can write for rates and other information to bloom@podvine.com. It's nothing like a pretentious email address. The second one I wanted to mention is Headscape. Obviously, Headscape is a web design company me and Marcus work for. We've never really pushed them that heavily. We're kind of throwing a vague mention in our podcast from time to time. But I did just want to say that we are a web design company based here in the UK. We like to consider ourselves pretty much a one-stop solution for web design. So we're not only a front-end interface design house, but we have technical back-end skills as well. So we are quite a rounded web design company. And obviously, we'd be interested to hear from you if you have any projects on the go. Unfortunately, we do only take on stuff in the UK at the moment. That's a conscious decision we've made. We don't take on stuff from the States simply because our insurance would be ridiculously high if we did, because obviously Americans like to sue one another. Also, I expect any American that ever listens to this podcast would refuse to work with us on principle. Well, there you go. But probably our kind of most major and important sponsor, because he's our first kind of completely external sponsor, is something called WriteCart. And WriteCart is just phenomenal. I'm really stoked that they've agreed to be a sponsor for the show. I promised you right at the beginning that we would only have sponsors that we actually believe in and we think have got good products, and WriteCart is a perfect example of that. Basically, it's so cool. It's a shopping cart and kind of e-commerce feature that you can just drop into basically any site very quickly and easily. So it's superb, for example, for blogs and things like that. If you just want to sell something through your blog, it's an excellent, easy way of adding e-commerce potential to your blog and kind of monetizing blogs. That's the key phrase these days, isn't it? We need to monetize our blogs. So if you're looking to sell stuff, really, this is a superb starting place. All you need to add this e-commerce feature to your site is three lines of HTML. That's all it takes. It's beautifully Ajaxed up, very slick, very nicely done. It's easy not only just to set up three lines of HTML, but it's also really easy to use. It's nicely integrated into the site and very straightforward. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a penny to add it to your site. You can get up and running, no setup costs at all. All WriteCart take is 1% per transaction. So basically, every time somebody buys something from your site, they'll take 1%, which I think is absolutely superb. It's by far the simplest system for adding e-commerce around. You can even sell other people's stuff. So if there's, for example, if you haven't got anything you directly want to sell yourself, you can go along to the WriteCart website and you can basically look through all the different products and add any products from their site to your website quickly and easy. How cool is that? And yeah, that's about it. So if you want to find out more about Reichart and try them out, we're certainly going to add them to the boagworld.com site before too long. Unfortunately, they don't support the UK yet, but when they do, we will be adding them. But if you want to add them to your site, you can do so by going to boagworld.com/Reichart. boagworld.com/Reichart, and that's R-I-G-H-T-C-A-R-T. Okay, so that about wraps it up for this show. Thank you very much for listening. As normal, you can post your comments on the show on our show notes that, as I said before, are available at boagworld.com/podcast. Next week's show is going to be on, I'm finally cracking down and deciding to do this, we're going to look at multiple devices, so mobiles and PDAs and things like that, and putting your website on those. I've been putting it off for a while, but I think I need to try and pick my way through this minefield. Because it's a bank holiday next Monday, do you know where bank holidays come from, Marcus?
Do you know? Do you?
No idea.
No, I don't. I don't know why they're called bank holidays.
So we got this thing in the UK called bank holidays, but I don't know where they come from or what they are. Anyway, we've got one next Monday, so that means the podcast will be out on Tuesday, the 29th of August instead. If you have any questions that you would like to be featured on the show, or comments, if you want to respond to the show in some way, you can send those to paul@boagworld.com. MP3 files would be much appreciated. It's always nice to hear other people's voices. Thanks for listening to this 46th episode at boagworld.com. Not long till 50. I'm sure we should be doing something really exciting at 50, but I don't know
what. We should. Definitely. No idea. I'll think about that one.
I was thinking about possibly trying to work out a way of doing a live show so that people can call in. But I don't know how. I haven't worked out how.
We'll have to have a think about that one.
We will. Thank you for listening to this 46th episode of PowerPoint.com. Look forward to speaking to you soon. Bye.
Bye.